online, smartphone, DSTV channel 856, and on 92.7 and 106 FM.
This is 702.
I'm 38. Thank you so much to the EWN team for that news and sports update. We are talking books and literature with literary journalist Karabo Kholeng, as we do every Saturday. Morning, Karabo.
Good morning, Rufile.
How are you doing in this rainy, lovely, Jersey weather? Perfect for curling up with a book, in fact.
Exactly. Perfect. Actually, I always accept the weather.
Yes.
Because we need the rain. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to complain.
Yes.
Because we were crying that it was very hot last week, so I'm going to be happy with the rain. And
yeah,
I'm in a position of privilege. You know, I get to be in a warm house. I get to go to Abundi today.
So jealous. So jealous. Nice life problems. And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about, looking ahead at the Abundi Book Fair. But you are going to be, I guess, in the presence of one of the authors that we're talking about, who's Mona Altahawi. She's going to be in conversation with Professor Pumla Dineo-Gola at 1 o'clock this afternoon.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know what? If I can't get a ticket, I'm going to have to sweet talk my way into that venue, because, you know, it's one of those gigs where I don't have to actually work. I just get to bask in their glory, you know?
Yeah. And drink it all in.
Imagine Feminist Rogue with Mona Altahawi.
I
can't wait. It's at 1 o'clock this afternoon, so.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about Mona's book.
Let's talk about it. The Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls. Unpack that for us.
So, you know how the Bible's got the seven deadly sins?
Mm, mm.
So, Mona takes on patriarchy by looking at the seven necessary sins that women have to commit and girls have to commit in order to establish freedom from patriarchy.
Yeah.
Right? And when we speak about freedom, because just being nice and asking for equality clearly hasn't worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, now it's about getting freedom.
Yeah.
It's like you can carry on with your bad self, but we want to be free from what patriarchy tells us what to do, right? So she begins by speaking of her experience when she attended Hajj when she was living in Saudi Arabia as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And Hajj is one of the cornerstones of the practice of Islam, because she's of Muslim descent. So she was born to Egyptian parents, spent some time in the UK, then lived in Saudi Arabia, then Egypt, and then back, and then to US. So she's like American Egyptian.
Yeah.
And she wrote about how she was sexually assaulted during the Hajj, which is a space
of all
where
places.
Women must be safe.
Of all places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, of all places, priests molest little boys in church, of all places.
Mm.
You know, we're not safe in our homes, of all places.
Mm.
And she talks about the trifecta of the oppression of women in a patriarchal world across all cultures and all religions.
Yeah.
So it's in the home, it's on the street, and it's in the state, and it's in religious spaces. So she kind of uses that to speak to the seven necessary sins. And she begins with number one, which is anger.
Yeah.
And how dare a woman of color from the Islamic faith be angry? And she speaks about, you know, virginity testing and sexual assault.
Yeah.
And she says the book is not a roadmap for making peace with patriarchy. It is a manifesto to dismantle patriarchy and to end its crimes.
Mm.
Because is peaceful patriarchy even beneficial to women? And then she starts questioning the whole idea of women who are foot soldiers to patriarchy. I call them patriarchal princesses, where, you know, they will accept the crumbs that patriarchy gives them in terms of positions of power.
Yeah.
And the exchanges for this protection, which is kind of nebulous, right? Because it's protection from what?
Yeah,
protection from them, protection for their children, protection for other women and women of color. And she started this hashtag called Mosque Me Too, where she spoke about being sexually assaulted in the mosque.
Yeah.
And other women started writing about Church Me Too, Temple Me Too. And she's built up such a huge, she's like an avalanche, this woman, that 5 million women in India, in Kerala, in India, at the beginning of this year, protested. 5 million.
Yeah.
They did a human chain in order to allow women to get into a temple that said, if you're premenstrual or you're postmenopausal, that's the only time you can enter that temple. So if you're of childbearing if you're if you're in the reproductive stage, which is any time between the ages of about 8 and what, 50 or 52.
Yeah.
You know, give or take.
I remember that story.
You are impure.
Yeah.
You know, so she speaks about even period poverty. And then she goes on. I mean, she comes, this is a short book, right?
Yeah.
And it is angry. But she speaks about, you know, what is worse, a woman's anger or the crimes of patriarchy against women and girls.
Yeah.
Just this week in Kimberley, a six-week-old baby was raped. Just this week, I mean, we've been speaking about this gender-based violence thing, you know, right now because it's the mood.
Mm,
we live with it every day.
Mm.
My sister, my late sister, she would be 35 years old if she didn't die because of her husband's behavior towards her 5 years ago.
Mm.
You know, we lived with this horror. I'm a survivor myself.
Yeah.
You know, and but for some reason, even the justice system would treat our anger with more harshness in order to protect men's sense of, I don't know, shame or, you know.
Mm.
And they say, no, not all of us are. Let's protect our women and sisters. Protect us from whom? Why
from
don't
ourselves.
You stop?
Mm.
Yeah.
Or essentially, let's police ourselves and let's police ourselves and change our behavior. Ultimately, no one would need protection from that point on.
Yeah, well, she says, you know, she writes even a Rage for Girls,
yeah.
A curriculum called A Rage for Girls. And she speaks about why it's important. Because the one time, you know, she was dancing in a club. And she was like, I was being grabbed at Hajj. I was grabbed at mosque. And then I'm grabbed at a nightclub.
Mm.
And this time she decided to beat the man up.
Yeah.
So she even talks about rage. She talks about violence. And she said, you know, how about if every time a man raped a woman or a man killed a woman, that women retaliated with the same treatment?
Mm.
And she's like, is it an incitement to violence? What's more unacceptable?
Yeah.
And then she also speaks about profanity, you know, where she says, F the patriarchy, because I also need to respect the broadcasting complaints authority and
please do.
From which I'm free. You know what? And
yeah.
The thing is, but I'm also calling myself on that, but also it's necessary, you know the word that I'm bleeping out, right?
Yeah, we all
but
know
she
it.
Says, what is more profane? And she uses the example of Stella Nyanzi, who was jailed for 5 weeks.
Mm.
For calling the president of Uganda a pair of buttocks.
Yeah.
Because he used period poverty to try and garner more votes and then said he can't afford to provide pads for poor Ugandan girls who don't make it to school, who end up being forced into sexual relationships just to have pads. Yet he can be bribed for billions, he can buy arms worth billions, and he can even fight other men with billions of dollars
who
try and take over. But when girls just need pads,
yeah,
is a problem.
Yeah.
So basically, essentially, she goes through the different senses. So I've spoken about profanity. She speaks about ambition and attention seeking. Like, who do you think you are? You're saying you are sexually assaulted for attention. You know the usual things that we get.
Yeah.
But one of the most important things she says, Lufila, before we go to the break, is that as women, we need to signal boost each other.
Yeah.
And this is where
and
I'd
that
like
means
to
what?
Honor you for doing that. That women who have attention must give attention to other women.
Yeah.
You know, women who don't have the same access, you know, for whatever reasons, that we need to keep signal boosting each other. So when you have a signal, you say, look, you know what? Could you? It's like that proverbial: you light the candle, and if you share the light of the candle with another candle, it's not going to make the candle less light.
Or put somebody else on. Put her on.
Yeah.
That's it.
Put her on. So thank you for signal boosting me, my friend.
You know what? You signal boost yourself, girl. I think in many ways, it's about recognizing actually people that have laid a very, very important and meaningful groundwork. And where the heck would you be without them? You know, and that's all that is. It just makes sense, Karabo, does it not? Just makes sense.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true.
You know, I was as in preparation for our talk or our discussion this morning, I was just reading through some of, you know, her quotes. Obviously, she also wrote, Mona Al-Tahawi also wrote Headscarves and Hymens. And she talks about the God of virginity being popular in the Arab world, but just being popular in many faiths, whether Muslim or Christianity. And it's just, you know, it's so important and interesting that if you look at, you know, overseas popular culture and the whole thing with rapper T.I., in fact, taking it upon himself to go and get his own daughter in 2019, modern day United States, taking her for his own version of virginity testing. And you think, my goodness, the things that preoccupy our minds, the things that we obsess over when real progress is at hand and needs to be made, you know, in terms of gender relations and equality. And yeah, people are still even now obsessed with this. But yeah, she makes some really, really just prescient and incisive points in her writing and in her public speaking. So I'm looking forward to hearing what comes out of the discussion this afternoon. I really am.
Oh, definitely. I mean, her final chapter in The Seven Necessary Sins is titled Lust.
Yeah.
You know, and she speaks about, you know, why is patriarchy so obsessed with controlling everybody else's bodies?
Mm.
And, you know, the issues of virginity testing, and she intersects, you know, feminism with the rights of LGBTQI people, which I completely agree with, because, you know, it's about entrenching the hegemony of people who are cis-hetero, normative, born male people, you know, and it goes across all of society. And her response is anger, which is not something, I mean, and it's rage and it's violence. And I get it, you know, even dealing with ambition, that we need to be ambitious. We need to pursue positions of power, but we need to also upset that power. Don't become the same system that you're trying to put down.
So, absolutely.
You know, if you become a boss, open the doors for other women. Don't behave like the boys.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to that discussion. Our second book is The Infinite Game. Is it by Simon Sinek?
Yay.
Tell me about that.
What I find interesting, it ties in very interesting ways, right? Because this is a book that is ostensibly written for people who want to succeed in business or in their careers. You know, so it's kind of, you know, it's motivational. I mean, that's the way that it's pitched, that's its selling point.
Yeah.
But it's one of the few books that I read on recommendation. So I've got some friends who are really smart and they read books that I don't always read. And this is one that I wouldn't ordinarily pick up.
Yeah.
So my homie was on some, hey, sis, you got to read this one.
Mm.
And it basically looks at life in two ways. That life is a game.
Yeah.
And it's either you play it as a finite game where there's a winner and a loser.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a soccer game, you know?
Yeah.
And it's timed.
Yeah.
And you need to score certain points more than this person, and then you win, and the game's over, and everybody goes home.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Or you can see life as an infinite game where you just stay to play.
Mm.
Right? And it's about building something bigger than just the game.
Yeah.
And he breaks it down according to, you know, what you need to practice in order to be a leader. And it reads as it's a business book, but I think this kind of counts in your own life.
Yeah.
Whether it's in, you know, your personal relationships, your relationship with yourself, or in the way that you see the world. And I sort of agree with it, because it speaks about how the first essential practice to living life as an infinite game, which is much more rewarding than a finite game, because you win today, what about tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you might relate to this because you're a broadcaster as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't look at life as you're just as good as yesterday's show. You're already thinking about tomorrow. You're already thinking about next week. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you're advancing a just course, right? Which is something that Alan Payton wrote about he wrote a memoir after he wrote Cry the Beloved Country. And he said that every generation will be judged by history according to whether they pursued a cause that was larger than themselves.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know,
yeah.
And I think for the children's generation right now, their cause is climate change. So advancing a just cause is the first essential practice to living life as an infinite game.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is to build trusting teams.
Yeah.
So you create a network around yourself and people who believe in the same cause. And then you must study your worthy rivals, which I love.
How do you define a worthy rival in this instance?
You know, there's a saying by Riley Freeman in The Boondocks.
Mm-hmm.
Game knows game.
Please quote Riley. That's beautiful.
Game knows game, and you're kind of looking unfamiliar right now. That's not a worthy rival.
Yes.
I want the game that looks familiar. It's like, oh, because then you learn from it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I think studying your worthy rivals is important. So people who, a finite game would say that you must beat them. The infinite game would say that you must take their best practices and apply them to how you do your game.
That's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you must prepare for existential flexibility, which is my favorite. Preparing for existential flexibility means anything can happen, so you must always be ready.
Yeah, and essentially that's it, right? Where, who are you when you're no longer relevant? Who are you when you're no longer riding the wave, right? Who are you when you are not having that fantastic show? Or who are you when the game, you've lost this particular battle, but, you know, the war still goes on or still continues?
Who are you when you're not getting the highest rating on weekend radio?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not about that, because you have to go back. What cause are you advancing?
Mm.
And then also demonstrate the courage to lead, which means for me it's about just getting up each day and showing up in your life.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, he writes this and he models, like he looks at, because he's spoken to people at like Microsoft and Apple. There was a time when Microsoft produced the Zune, which was the competition to the iPod,
yes.
And it actually sold more units than the iPod. And the leader of Apple was just like, okay, you know?
Yeah.
And the origins of Microsoft is about making people advance themselves in life.
Yeah.
And then it became about the bottom line.
Mm.
So it went from an infinite game a la Bill Gates to the finite game, which is just bottom line, bottom line, bottom line.
Yeah.
And then Apple took over with their infinite game about, you know, creating products that are almost feel intuitive when you use them.
Yeah.
And now their game is becoming finite because, I mean, like how many iPhone XXXs are you going
to
have?
And how many cameras can you fit onto one?
Yeah, and designed obsolescence.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that's the story of business, and that's my excellent critique on capitalism. Kodak, it was the same thing. Kodak revolutionized the way that corporate companies behave.
Yeah.
They were one of the first corporate companies to give paid sick leave. Paid sick leave was not a thing before Kodak, right? But then they had so much hubris that, you know, when cameras went to the phone
and became digital photography came about, they didn't go there either.
Yeah. They tanked. And it was the same thing with blockbuster videos, you know. After the DVD, they thought they were just going to do, you know, DVD till the death, and then, you know, now you've got Netflix, and maybe they should have like bought into Netflix.
Yeah.
So, you know, but that's the thing with capital. I think that capitalism is a finite game unless it's practiced in a way that benefits society. But that's a political discussion for another day.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, capitalism and as a byproduct, popular culture and the way we are currently living, that finite game, you're always on, right? If you're on social media, remember that hashtag, we grind while they sleep.
You know? Nice. And,
yeah, we sleep. We get our 8 hours in, you know. But it really is such an interesting critique. So this you'd find in the business section, but very, very applicable, I guess, to life and everyday life. I think it's a very interesting framework that Simon set up. I'm often very wary of self-help books because I want to know how you're doing your life, right? It's like Arianna Huffington telling us, writing a book about sleeping after she's made her billions. That time she had to grind whilst we were sleeping. And now that she's got the money, she's telling us to rest. We're like, no, what?
Yeah. You know? No, but this book, The Infinite Game, I think to me it speaks to more about values because he makes brilliant historical references. For example, Nikolai Vavilov, who was a botanist in Leningrad, and he created the first ginormous, I know people don't like that word, seed bank. And from that came the seed banks that are basically keeping food technology alive.
Yeah.
And he was idealistic, and the team that he built around himself, you know, to the extent that when
he was exiled, right? He was actually exiled, and they kept the work going despite poverty and hunger and starvation around them.
He was tortured.
Yeah.
And he only died at the age of 52, but they carried on. Even Hitler tried to, like, smash and grab the seed bank, you know?
Mm.
But he was playing the infinite game.
Absolutely.
You know, he also speaks about, Simon Sinek also writes about, you know, Vietnam. How come more Vietnamese soldiers died in the Vietnam War than the U.S. war, but Vietnam won the war.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it was about like the long game and knowing the history, you know. So I like calling it the infinite game because I used to call it the long game when I speak about life and people ask me like, why do you stop this when this seems to be going so good? I'm just like, no, I'm just pushing back because, you know, this is a long game.
And
so it's not about right now.
Yeah.
It's about staying the course. And sometimes I need to take some time off, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Karabo, well, thank you so much. It was lovely chatting to you. We'll catch up again next week. Please give us some feedback on Ubuntu. I'll be working, so I cannot make it through this weekend. But
I'm going to give you the feedback.
Have a good one, Karabo.
We'll see you next week,
my dear. We'll chat next week.
All right. Cheers, Wifile.
All right. Looking forward to the feedback coming out of the Ubuntu Book Festival. 9:58.